About 20 years ago, I visited a friend in San Antonio, Texas. Anybody ever been to San Antonio? Yeah. Do you know the way to San? Do you know the way to San Jose? Sorry, wrong city. But it's a beautiful city. Would you, those of you gone, would you agree? I loved it actually. It's a unique gathering of Anglo and Hispanic culture. And mind you, it was in the middle of summer, August, so it was about 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 40 plus degrees, but it was hot, but it was the dry hot, so it's not quite so hot. But San Antonio is famous for several things. The one that I was most interested in was the Alamo. There's the Alamo. You know, the thing about the Alamo, it's much smaller than I expected. It's a dinky little thing. You go through it and you're, you know, in a matter of seconds, it seems. Alamo, if you don't know, was a fort held by the Texans. Actually, it was a missionary complex that was turned into a fort. Texas was actually, at that time, under Mexico's control. And the Texans revolted against Mexico. General Santa Anna came up with the Mexican army, and the Alamo was ground zero of the Texas Rebellion against Mexico. All the Texans that were in the Alamo were killed, like a couple of hundred. Nobody knows exactly how many. And it's become sacred ground for Texans. In fact, it says on the Alamo website, stand in awe at the Shrine of Texas Liberty and explore the 1836 battlefield where heroes fell. The ongoing effort to restore the dignity and reverence to the Alamo is underway. Now, when I went to the Alamo, I was struck by the fact that when I entered that space, I was entering into a different world, a world that was unfamiliar to me, a world that maybe you've had that experience entering into when you cross a threshold into another way of seeing and understanding, when you cross into someone else's sacred space. The Alamo site at the time, I think it's still today the case, was run by the Daughters of the Republic of Texas. Think about that, the Daughters of the Republic of Texas. When I visited the Alamo, I knew this group meant serious business. There were members of the Daughters of the Republic of Texas spaced out through the Alamo, right throughout the building, watching everything you did. See, because you're in sacred ground here, you better watch what you're doing. One of the rules was don't touch the stonework. I guess, if you touch stone, it slowly fades away if you do that. Now, I have a problem when people tell me not to do something. I want to do it. Do you have that problem at all, any of you? What are you? Are you just conformists? Or when people tell you not to do something, that's what you want to do? God tells Adam and Eve in the garden, don't eat that fruit. And where are they? Right away, right? They're over by the tree that has the fruit they're not to touch. My mom would bring out these hot plates when I was a kid and tell me, don't touch the plate, it's really hot. And of course, I'd have to touch the plate. And then I'd make some kind of joke, oh, it's not that hot, even when it really was. I wanted so badly to touch the wall of the Alamo, but I didn't dare. Because I didn't want one of those Daughters of the Republic of Texas on my back. So I kept my hands to myself, thankfully. Because it would have been sacrilege to do so, really, truly, wouldn't it? The name Jerusalem, and I got a beautiful picture of Jerusalem up there. Do you know what it means, the city of peace? Shalom, right? Salem, that's another variation on shalom. It means peace. Jerusalem is sacred ground for many in the world. It's the home for important spot for three world religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. This city of peace, this sacred ground, has been destroyed at least twice in history, from what we know. It's been besieged 23 times. It's been captured and recaptured 44 times. It's been attacked at least 52 times in its 3,000 plus year history. An interesting city of peace, don't you think? What does it say about our world that the city of peace is consumed by war and violence, even to this very day? The Temple Mount is the focal point in Jerusalem. In fact, if you go online, it's hard to find a picture of Jerusalem without the Temple Mount in the picture. It's the location of where both Jewish temples were built. The first one built by Solomon in the 10th century BC, and the second one built by Herod in the 1st century BC. In fact, the second temple was still being worked on 50 or so years later when Jesus was doing his ministry. And I'm not sure it ever got completed, to be honest, before it was knocked down by the Romans. The Temple Mount was the sacred center of Judaism. Now, did you notice in those two pictures that the temples are reconstructions? They're actually artistic drawings? That's because both versions of the temple were destroyed, knocked over. The sacred ground of Judaism was trampled on, the first one by the Babylonians and then later the second one by the Romans. And there are still ruins of the second temple in existence on Temple Mount. Eventually, hundreds of years later, Muslims conquered Jerusalem in the 7th century AD and put a mosque on top of the Temple Mount. At the time, the Jewish character of Jerusalem was very weak. You see, the Jews had been expelled from Jerusalem, told never to come back. So there wasn't many of them in the 7th century living in Jerusalem. I think they might have put a pagan temple up on the Temple Mount for a little while, but then Islam conquers Jerusalem and the Muslims put up the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the very top of Temple Mount. Why did they put a temple there? Well, because a mosque, they put one there because that's the reported place where Muhammad went up to heaven at the end of his life. Muslim sacred ground too, and there's been a mosque there ever since. So now we have the overlay of two faiths who claim the same space as sacred ground. And if you go to Temple Mount, and I've never been there, but I read this, there are very specific instructions of what you can and cannot do there, because it is someone's sacred space. Israel Tourism says this: if you have any religious artifacts or articles on you, regardless if they are Christian or Jewish, you will not be permitted to bring these items in with you. Save your shopping for after your visit. You may be denied entry for carrying religious artifacts with you. It is amazing to me how human beings can make places or things into sacred places and sacred things. We have our sacred taboos, our sacred cows, we might call them. I think everybody does, every culture does, every person has them. If it's not a place or a thing, it could be a word or an idea or some goal or purpose. In everyone's life and in all societies, there are sacred things that should never be touched. Lines that should never be crossed or even threatened. And woe be to the one who crosses or threatens that line. Now, Jesus is considered probably the greatest spiritual teacher of all time, even by many non-Christians. You just have to read through the Sermon on the Mount. There's absolutely profound spiritual teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, even if you're not a Christian. The spiritual teachings about God, about life, about the meaning of life. Jesus reframes the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. He reframes it that we are to treat people as we would want to be treated. He reframes it, and this becomes a completely brilliant insight into how we're to live with each other. I don't know how many of you remember The Vicar of Dibley. Do you remember that show at all? It's a comedy show from Britain. If you haven't seen it, it's pretty funny. The first episode of the Vicar of Dibley, the priest, Geraldine Granger, says to her congregation that she became a priest because of the Sermon on the Mount. It blew her mind. It captured her heart. And Geraldine was not the first or the last person to experience this. Jesus' commitment to healing and blessing others, that's inspiring. His willingness to connect with the outcast and abandoned, something we treasure. Jesus' capacity to forgive, admirable. Then Jesus is riding in on a donkey into Jerusalem today. He's playing around with Old Testament prophecy from the book of Zechariah. He's stoking people's expectations about Messiah. Is that what he really wants to be doing? Does that make any sense, Jesus? This might not turn out so well for you. I don't think something good can come from this. So what are you up to, Lord? Then Jesus goes into the temple and he's looking around and his face is set as flint. There is determination in his face, his countenance. What are you thinking, Lord? I hope you're not thinking what I'm thinking. Because you seem to be walking with great determination ahead of me and you're striking terror into the hearts of those who follow you. Seems that you're preparing to play around with the sacred ground of your people. You're going to push on some things. You're going to push on the one thing that binds your people as one. This can bring you down, Lord. Why would you do this? In everyone's life and in all societies, there are sacred things that should never be touched, lines that should never be crossed, or even threatened, and woe be to the one who crosses or threatens the line. Jesus is far ahead of his disciples today. He no longer seems to be someone we can easily understand. He's not the counselor or friend we've been told about. He has a point of view of which I personally know nothing of, or any one of us, perhaps. And all we can do is stand around and look at him in amazement. There was a time we were confident that we understood what he was about, but today we're not sure what's going on inside of him or what his goal is for the moment. You know, the rest of the Gospel of Mark up until Jesus' arrest is rooted in conversations in and around the temple. Everything that Jesus does or reaches out to is now connected with the temple. Everything he teaches is about the temple. Everything that he challenges in some way can be teased back to the temple. Think about him overturning all those money lenders and sellers of pigeons and doves in the temple. He overturns their tables in the temple, and he's saying to the authorities this, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it into a den of thieves." When Jesus does this, he touches something that should not be touched. He crosses a line that should not be crossed. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised by this. It was characteristic of Jesus and how he lived in the world with people. But this characteristic is going to cost him his life. And the question still remains, why? Why, Lord? I think my best take on it is this, that God is going to challenge all of us in the place that we hold most sacred. God will challenge us at the place that we value as most precious. God will challenge us at the place where we find the most meaning, the place that gives us the most significance in life. That's where God's challenge is going to take place for each of us. Now, I don't know where that sacred spot in you is. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the line or the threshold crossing over it is for you personally. It could be a place. It could be like the Alamo or maybe the Temple Mount. For some, it could be the Scotiabank Arena where the Maple Leafs play. What an ugly building that is, though. If that's your sacred place, I much prefer Maple Leaf Gardens than to the new arena they built years ago. That sacred space might be a shrine to the fallen dead, like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in downtown Ottawa. You know, that Freedom Convoy a few weeks back, there's some uproar about the tomb being defaced because somebody's sacred line had got crossed over. It could be a great religious artifact like the Kaaba Blackstone in Mecca. Our most holiest and sacred places might be an idea or a word like justice or fraternity or forgiveness or freedom, wealth, autonomy, education. I know people who worship education or money. That's their sacred center. It might be a special relationship. Your sacred place might be a special relationship with a parent or a grandparent, with a friend or a spouse, with a mentor or a hero. Any word or idea or relationship can be elevated into a place of sacred position in us. But the problem is that it's almost certain because of our sinful and twisted ways, we will elevate into the sacred place within us something that falls short of what is truly sacred. It will be an imposter of some sort or another. It's almost certain that what each of us most values in life, what we worship, what we defend, what we will protect, is something that ultimately cannot bear the weight of the sacred. It won't be able to deliver the goods in truth, even if it's a good thing in and of itself. I've been reading a biography of Joseph Stalin. Stalin was probably responsible for more deaths than any other person in the 20th century, more than Adolf Hitler. 20 to 30 million people died because of Joseph Stalin. When you read about Stalin, though, you find that he is a man possessed with a passion for social justice. He had a zeal for creating a true utopia on earth. Social justice was his sacred vision, his sacred ground. The sacred ground empowered him to create untold human suffering and death. His quest for justice created so much injustice in life, it's hard to fathom. How could someone so committed to justice create so much injustice? But then, how could a temple created to be a house of prayer for all the nations become a den of thieves? We have all filled up the sacred space in us with that which is incapable of bearing the full weight of the sacred. And when that happens, we make it a weight that gets deformed in us, that sacred presence becomes deformed under the pressure within us. It becomes an impediment, a barrier to the truly sacred in our lives. And justice cannot stand on its own. It cannot bear the weight of the sacred on its own, and neither can wealth or education or a beautiful building. There is only one sacred source that works for us. The Bible makes that very clear. There's one sacred source for it. It is an awakened and living relationship with God. It's not an idea about God. It's not knowing that God exists. It's not even believing in God. It's an awakened and living relationship with God. That's what this is all about here at Trillium. Even a holy temple dedicated to God can become the very thing that interferes with a relationship with God. It can become an idol for us, a place or an object of interference. And if that can happen with God's temple on Temple Mount, then anything and everything can become interference for us if it is elevated into the sacred position. Jesus is going to challenge that which Israel holds as most sacred. Jesus is going to challenge that which Israel values as most precious. Jesus is going to challenge Israel at the place she finds most meaning and the deepest significance. Jesus is going to challenge the very place Israel believes God is found, which is in the temple. Jesus has come, actually, today to tear the temple down. Not physically, of course, but mentally. Spiritually. And in its place, Jesus is going to offer Israel an awakened and living relationship with the Creator of the universe. And we know what that is going to cost him. Because, see, we understand what it means to cross sacred boundaries. But do we understand that Jesus is only starting with Israel? That he's coming today to challenge Israel? that which we most value as precious. He's coming to challenge you and me at the place that we find the most meaning and the deepest significance in our lives. Jesus is going to challenge you at the very place you believe God is found. That's why perhaps we really don't understand what he's up to today. Jesus has come to tear our temples down, our created sacred spaces. Not physically, necessarily, but certainly mentally and spiritually. And in his place, Jesus is offering you and me an awakened and living relationship with the Creator of the universe. And the question is whether what are we going to do when he comes to us? Are we going to welcome him into the inner sanctum? Or will we crucify him like the world does?